My name is Jacqueline Farinella. I'm a co-chair of the committee, and I want to thank everyone for joining the Art and Cultural Heritage Law Committee's first telecoffee discussion. As I mentioned, we are recording this call, and we will post the audio file to the committee's webpage. So we do ask that all the listeners please mute your lines during the call. If you have any questions, feel free to email me. I'll be checking my email during the call. It's Jacqueline Farinella at Gmail, and it's included in the invite to the call if you need it. And we will address any questions at the conclusion of the discussion as time permits. If you could please mute your line for the discussion, we'd appreciate it. All right, let's get going. Today's telecopy is titled Representing Foreign States, a discussion of recent cultural heritage spaces with Lena Lopez. Ms. Lopez is a member of the committee and is counsel at Berliner, Corcoran, and Rowe in D.C. Lena's practice includes foreign sovereign immunity law, commercial litigation, international law, and cultural heritage law. Lena hosts the Foreign Sovereign blog at foreignsovereignblog.com, where she discusses U.S. laws affecting foreign sovereigns and reviews case law that's relevant to the area. Lena, thanks for speaking with us today about your practice. Why don't we get started by discussing your professional background, and maybe you can tell us a little bit about how you got into foreign sovereign immunity law and the cultural heritage practice more specifically.
Sure. thank you for having me on this telecoffee, and I look forward to any questions people have today. But I we have to really go back before I even went into law school. I worked for Jimmy Carter down at the Carter Center, his post-presidency initiative. And I was fresh out of college, and I was an editor in his press department. And I looked with envy at the people, what the people were doing who had multiple degrees. They were working on international election monitoring and other interesting projects. So I decided I needed my own further degree. So I went to law school in D.C. at American, and American is known for its international law. And I just kind of stuck with that interest. And during law school, I was hired by a very well-known lawyer, Michael Tiger, who was doing a trial for John Demjanjuk, who at the time, he's since deceased, but he was basically charged with lying on his immigration forms and was a alleged former Nazi. So I helped Mr. Tiger in that trial, and it spurred my interest of litigation. So it was definitely the catalyst for combining international law with litigation. And since that time, I have been doing just that. I did clerk for a federal judge, and that took me out of international-specific litigation, but certainly litigation. And I worked for a plaintiff class action firm for 2 years, but I then switched over to the defense side at Berliner, Corcoran, and Rowe, gosh, going on 9 years now.
Okay. And, you have to listen to this.
And I've been there ever since.
Great. And so, and since you've started at the firm, what are some of the cases that have come through that impact the cultural heritage field that you've been having the opportunity to work on?
Well, it's interesting because my interest in cultural heritage and art cases really was spurred by one case that came in the door. We had been representing Iran in several other proceedings, and one case that they called us about was a cultural artifact case where certain plaintiffs who held judgments from terrorism cases couldn't satisfy their judgments, meaning Iran would not pay voluntarily. And so they started attachment proceedings against certain museums in Chicago and Massachusetts. And Iran appeared in the Chicago litigation, and we represented them in that Chicago litigation. It's still going on. We don't have as active of a role now, but at the time when I started with the case, we were dealing with not only the cultural heritage aspects of the case and whether those could be attached or whether they were immune, But also the plaintiffs asked us for what's called general assets discovery, where they said, all right, if you're not going to give us your artifacts, then tell us what else you have in the United States. And we were successful in shutting that effort down in the Court of Appeals.
And so clearly one of the most critical pieces of legislation in your practice or in those types of cases and in representing foreign sovereigns is the Foreign Sovereign Immunity Act of 76. Maybe you could tell us a little bit the role of that act in your practice generally and what aspects of the act are more relevant to cultural property lawsuits or the one that you've mentioned.
Sure. That is the act for suing a foreign sovereign. So if you want to sue a foreign sovereign or if a plaintiff wants to sue a foreign sovereign, the only way to get jurisdiction over a foreign sovereign is the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act. And the Supreme Court has held that very clearly. So the act sets forth the general proposition, which is that foreign states are generally immune from the jurisdiction of U.S. courts, except in certain enumerated exceptions. And those exceptions are laid out in the act, and that's where the litigation happens for the most part, is over those exceptions. And some of the more prominent ones are commercial activity, when the foreign sovereign is acting like a commercial player in the market rather than a regulator of the market, or the tort exception, where there's a tort that's been committed on U.S. soil and the foreign sovereign is the responsible party. And there's some other ones, but they're just not as heavily litigated.
I know you review cases and U.S. law that's relevant to foreign sovereigns on your blog. Have you gotten a sense that recent case law has either strengthened the ability of individuals to bring suits against foreign sovereigns under the act, or has it gone one way or the other?
I don't know if I would say it's strengthened the ability to bring suits. I mean, it really depends on the facts of each suit of whether it qualifies for the exceptions to immunity. And I don't think I could make a blanket statement about that.
Yeah.
I would say, though, that there has been some more creative efforts, particularly in this cultural heritage field, both by plaintiffs and by foreign states attorneys. And I can just give you a couple of examples. Recently, there was a case brought against Russia by the Chabad organization, which was seeking return of what the Chabad organization considered their cultural artifacts, which were a collection of books, religious books. And they sued Russia, and Russia appeared and said, we're immune from this lawsuit, and the courts of the District of Columbia disagreed. And after that, Russia basically gave them the snub and said, we're not going to appear any longer. And they instructed their attorneys to withdraw from the suit. And since then, the Chabad organization has been trying to obtain the artifacts, which the court has said you have a right to have, through diplomacy, really, because Russia has refused to appear. And it's both creative by the plaintiffs for what they're trying to achieve and by Russia for taking that extreme step of withdrawing rather than seeing it to fruition in the litigation. And the most recent development in the case is that the district court agreed with the plaintiffs and granted sanctions against Russia for failing to follow the court order to the tune of $50,000 a day for not doing what the court has ordered, which is a very extreme sanction and, in my mind, having my advocacy hat on, too extreme for against foreign sovereigns because of the diplomatic problems that it could cause.
Yeah. And there is, of course, a lot of discussion of tension between diplomacy and the implementation of this act. And is that something that you've also seen in case law, that tension and the discussion, some of the outcomes of these cases?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, the courts are always concerned with, on the one hand, and the act has been written for this purpose, on the one hand, to allow a plaintiff with a valid claim to pursue that claim against a foreign state, and on the other hand, to protect the immunities of foreign sovereigns for purposes of foreign relations. So there's definitely a tension there, and which side wins can often come down to whether the court wants to put at a higher level the interest of the plaintiffs or the interest of the sovereign. So yes, that tension is there in every lawsuit.
Right. Yeah. Well, we got a question in, so I'm going to just pause our discussion and put it out there. Nicholas O'Donnell, thanks for sending it in. Lena, what are your general thoughts on the Foreign Cultural Exchange Jurisdictional Immunity Clarification Act? It was passed last year in the House and it's been proposed to the Senate. Have you heard anything concrete about possible reintroduction in the current session? And this came from Mr. O'Donnell. Are you familiar with that, or do you have any?
I am, yeah. And let me just, for the benefit of the call, give a little bit of background. So in light of several cases, but one of the cases was the Malevich case, as well as the Rubin case, which I described, the Iranian case, there's been a proposal to amend the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act. And in effect, it would forbid lawsuits against foreign states regarding art that has been protected by the immunity law, the IFSA. And it would allow art and cultural property to not be attached and taken to satisfy judgments, for example. Now, the exception would be for lawsuits that are related to Nazi looted art. And that has been the kind of the fly in the ointment for the bill. And I don't know whether there's been a lot of action this year. I haven't checked to see what the latest is, but I do believe that there's going to be some further action on it. And I think where the rubber is going to meet the road is how to deal with the Nazi looted art and which way the Congress will handle that exception, because the exception could end up swallowing the rule. So I don't know that I really have a position on it, other than as an advocate, again, for foreign sovereigns. I would just want to make sure that the immunities of foreign sovereigns are held at a highest standard.
Mm-hmm. Thanks. So you've mentioned this ongoing case against Russia. Are there any other cases that you've come across that might be in flux where the outcome could have a big impact on this practice or this area?
Well, I mentioned the Malevich case, and that
right.
one is it's an interesting decision in that it never was appealed, and so it's a district court case, and after the district court case came out, the parties settled. So just to give people a little background on that, what happened, if you bring over an art collection from abroad and you want it to be protected in the United States, you can have the museums apply to the State Department for a grant of immunity from seizure, so that if it comes into the United States, it's essentially protected. Well, in the Malevich case, the court said that in that particular case, under the facts and circumstances of that case, the artwork that had come over from abroad was not protected from seizure, even though it had received this IFSA grant. And so that caused kind of a shift in the law, and it concerned museums and foreign states alike, because they were not secure in this IFSA protection. So that's what this bill is trying to address.
Right.
And you know, the proof will be in the pudding. I just don't know if there's going to be a way to satisfy all interest groups, both museums and the Nazi looted art community. So we'll have to see. But that really was an interesting cultural property case, because it dealt with both a foreign state, the museum community, and of course the private plaintiffs who wanted their artwork back.
Yeah. Yeah, there are a lot of conflicting perspectives there. So.
Yeah, and one other facet that I'd like to mention with regard to the Iran case.
Mm-hmm.
You asked me about the tension of immunity versus the plaintiff, and one thing that was fairly fascinating about the Iran case was the United States came in support of Iran's position. Now, it also happened to be the museum's position, so it's not that the United States was supporting Iran as a foreign nation. They were supporting the idea of immunity, and the most important reason why is because immunity is based on reciprocal rights. So right. It's purely based on comity, which is a fancy way of the golden rule, do unto others mm-hmm. as you'd have them do unto you. And if we have a practice in the United States of allowing cultural artifacts to be attached in the circumstances of that case and sold to the highest bidder, then the same thing may well happen abroad to U.S. artifacts and art.
Yeah. Is that common that the U.S. would have a position in cases where it's not a party?
Well, the U.S. has a right to come in and file what's called a statement of interest if it does have a interest. And so it can't just file for the sake of making its position known.
Right.
It does have to have some sort of valid interest. And, of course, in that case, it certainly did. And it is, I wouldn't say it's the rule, but it is common to see statements of interest filed by the United States in suits that involve the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act, because it is so important for the reciprocity of how the U.S. is treated abroad.
Is that generally, I mean, I'm sure it's not one position and it's very case-specific, but in general, does the U.S. seem to lean towards supporting immunity for issues of comity and diplomacy? Do you find their position to be somewhat political?
Yeah, I mean, the reason they would come in is because they want to take a stand on something regarding immunity. And
mm-hmm.
I'm trying to just conceive off the top of my head if there's been a time when they've come in and said, don't worry about it, the foreign sovereign's not immune. There probably is a circumstance, but it would surprise me if they would file in that circumstance. More than likely, they would just not say anything and let the court handle it, because the assumption that the United States would have is that the court will, quote-unquote, get it right and determine that this foreign sovereign's not immune. But if the court is not predisposed to, quote, get the decision right, then the United States, I think, has more of an interest to say, this is a time when we really think that the sovereign is immune, and don't be tempted by the plaintiff's position. This is really important to us because we might face something similar across the pond or across any of the ponds that surround us. So, you know, I think that, again, I don't have all of the United States statements of interest in my mind right now, but
right.
The ones that I recall the most are when they're trying to defend the position of immunity. And, for example, in Russia, the Russia case, even though Russia hadn't appeared because they withdrew, the United States strongly opposed the issuance of sanctions against Russia.
Right. And so let's say in cultural heritage cases, where Foreign Sovereign Immunity Act is invoked, what are some of the exceptions that are most common? Would it be the commercial activity exception? Again, I know it's fact-specific, but what are the aspects of the act that are most relevant to cultural heritage?
Yeah, the commercial activity exception does come up, and one argument has been advanced by the plaintiff's bar, which is that a foreign sovereign acts like a commercial player when it, in effect, acts like a museum. And that's heavily debated because one could argue that a museum is not commercial at all. But on the other hand, the plaintiffs have argued that it generates revenue, and therefore is commercial. The other exception that often comes into play is the expropriation exception, where plaintiffs have alleged that their property has been taken in violation of international law and they've not been compensated for it.
Yeah.
And that also gets frequently litigated. One avenue that gets litigated is there's a doctrine called the domestic takings rule, which says that a foreign state does not violate international law if it takes the property of its own citizens. And there was one ruling in a case involving Hungary and artwork where the court said, well, the Jews at the time of the Hungarian Holocaust were stripped of their citizenship, and therefore the taking did not fall within the domestic takings exception. So, again, lots of individual issues that crop up, but those two exceptions are the ones that seem to come up frequently in the art and cultural heritage world.
Yep. And as you said, it seems lately cases, plaintiffs and defendants have getting more creative with their approach to the act in these suits.
I think so. I think, you know, for a while, for the first 20 years, people were just trying to figure out the act. And now that 20 years has passed, and we're kind of in the next 20 years where people are not pursuing the arguments that have been brought and lost, but now are trying to advance it to the next level, which always brings creative lawyering.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't have any other questions that came in by email. We have a few more minutes, so I will open the call if anyone would like to ask a question before we conclude. Well, Lena, thanks so much for speaking with us. Sorry, is there someone?
I'm sorry?
I thought maybe someone was asking a question. Well, thanks again for speaking with us, and thanks everyone for joining the call. I would like to invite anyone who does have further questions, Lena, you're open to having them reach out to you directly, right? And Lena's email is lcl@bcr-dc.com. And please also visit her blog at foreignsovereignblog.com. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you, Jacqueline.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye. Thanks for joining.